Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Military History Inside Out. Today I speak with Dr. Timothy Smith. He's written a lot of books on the Civil War. And today we talk about his book on Grant at the Vicksburg Campaign. As he puts it, there's been a lot written about Grant, a lot written about the Vicksburg Campaign, but almost nothing about specifically about Grant at Vicksburg and details about that. We talk about that, obviously. We go into a little bit about Grant in general, about the Civil War in general. A very interesting little part about the way Civil War generals thought, what sort of training they had, and how Grant broke away from that mold. So enjoy. I'm speaking with Dr. Timothy Smith, author of The Decision Was Always My Own, Ulysses S. Grant and the Vicksburg Campaign. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me first, how did you get into writing and studying about Civil War history?
Well, I've always been interested in Civil War history and history in general. And I had always wanted to write and interested in, researching and family history, genealogy, and all that. But it was actually when I was a sophomore, I guess, at Ole Miss, I took a course under Dr. David Sampson in the Old South. And that just solidified what I wanted to do. I thought, I want to be him. And so I, of course, went on and got the graduate degrees and all that kind of stuff. And that's just part of it. That's the fun part is, of course, the teaching's fun too, but the research and writing, all that's a lot of fun.
So how many books have you written on the Civil War?
We're up to probably 19 or 20 now.
Okay, and I assume you've written a lot of articles as well.
Oh, yeah.
So let's talk about the book. Tell me about it.
All right. Well, this is the Grant and Vicksburg Campaign, of course. Mm-hmm. And there's really not a lot centered on Grant himself during the Vicksburg Campaign. There's a lot on Grant, of course. And there seems to be a biography of the week coming out now on him. And there's a lot on the Vicksburg Campaign, but nothing particularly emphasizing Grant since Myers' book in the 1950s. So thought it was something that needed to be done. And what really was the start of it, I'm a series editor with John Marzalek, who you may know, your listeners will definitely know, the biographer of Sherman and Halleck and lots of different books on the Civil War. He and I are co-editing a series with Southern Illinois University Press on Ulysses S. Grant. They're the publisher, of course, that did the, I think it's 32 volumes of the Grant papers, John Simon, and that series wrapped up, and they thought it was time then to go into a series of monographs on Grant's life. So we are co-editing that series and have several books already out on various aspects of Grant's life, such as his world tour after his presidency. There's one coming out on Grant's Indian policy, kind of a revisionist history of that, and then, of course, this Vicksburg Campaign. We've got a lot of other books in the works by historians that you have heard of, Steve Woodworth, Dave Powell, several others that are in process now. So it's an interesting little series.
So I noticed with this particular book, there were 8 points noted as far as sort of special things that Grant did in order to succeed in the Vicksburg Campaign. Looking over them, they didn't seem revolutionary to me, so I'm just curious, from your vantage point, the things he did, how were they revolutionary? What was different about his thinking?
Well, of course, the idea is that obviously Vicksburg has been treated before, so none of it is new. I mean, there's no real groundbreaking anything. What is groundbreaking, I guess, is that it's told from Grant's perspective. There's a whole lot of his personal life and dealings, with his family and Julia and administration of his department in the midst of all the the military and all that. So that's one part of it. But in terms of his decisions, his actual decision making process, it is a little bit revolutionary, because what Grant does, particularly in, and I forget what decision it was. It was like decision number 4 or 5 or whatever, to cross the river and go south of Vicksburg. That was just pretty much unheard of at time. That was the type of operation that you just didn't do. And everybody tried to talk him out of it. Sherman was not in favor of it. Sherman wrote him that letter, you know, that everybody termed a protest, that Sherman later says, oh, it's not really a protest, but Sherman was not in favor of it. He wanted to go back and have a secure line of supply from Memphis and down the railroads and all that kind of stuff. Grant knew that his superior also in Washington would not approve of it, because this just was not the standard way that you operate militarily, without a supply line and all that kind of stuff. And so Halleck, who had never really been in Grant's corner to begin with, certainly would not have approved. But what Grant had on his side, of course, was that he was out of touch. And one of my favorite parts of the books, he writes that that once he crosses the river and starts northward from Bruinsburg and all that, he would be out of touch for well over a week. And he made the comment, you could do a lot in 8 days. By the time word got back to Washington and then orders got back to Grant in the wilderness of Mississippi, you know, not to do it, Grant would already pretty much have it done. So he said, you can do a lot in 8 days, and he did.
So in the Grant's letters and correspondence that you used for this, did he, how much sort of doubt or soul searching was he doing during the siege? Was there any of that, or was he just, you know, just a go-get-em kind of attitude?
Well, maybe dealing with semantics here a little bit, but in terms of the siege itself, that there was no doubting or soul-searching then. It's just a matter of time at that point, because, you know, he knows he has Vicksburg wrapped up, and it's just a matter of time. But now, during the earlier campaign, the siege is only, you know, 6 weeks or so at the tail end of the 9-month campaign. And so during that campaign, the 9 months of it, of course, there is some soul searching. There is some rethinking. There's a whole lot of adaptation that he has to, you know, he tries this move and it doesn't work. And then he tries something else. Ultimately, 6 different attempts to capture Vicksburg, and none of them work. And so he has to adapt on the fly. He has to come up with new ideas. And at one point he, and this is another part of my favorite part of the story, he gets to the point that he just almost gives up and says, okay, we've just got to assault up the bluffs, and it's going to be bloody, and it's probably going to be a defeat, but this is our last resort. There's nothing else logically that we can do. And then he decides, he goes and looks at those bluffs one more time, and he decides, no, I just can't sacrifice that many men in this attempt that may not work anyway. And that's when he decides to go, you know, off the charts and throw the book away and call a play that's just so unconventional. It's kind of like a Hail Mary, you know, a play that, you know, nobody would have thought of. And it goes against all the maxims of war and tactical and strategic theory and all of that. But of course it worked.
So you talk about, or I saw that in the book, you discuss sort of the political issues he had to deal with.
Right.
Before we get to that, were there, as far as his correspondence, who were the main people that he corresponded with during this, you know, the whole campaign, you know, family, friends, other military people or politicians?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. This book was a little different than others that I have done, in that most of these books, you know, you go search out every single archives and repository, special collections, you know, to find every document you can find on this subject. But this book was a little bit different in that, number one, most of his military correspondence has already been published in the official records. And so I didn't deal a whole lot with battle reports, which, you know, the official records, most of the time you read those for battle reports and all that. But the correspondence is where you really get the most information over the long term, you know. And so a lot of his correspondence was done in official records. This 32-volume grant papers that I talked about with Southern Illinois University Press, fortunately, they had been published, and that included a whole lot of his private correspondence as well. So I didn't have to go doing, you know, a whole lot of digging and treasure hunts and all that, because really most of the correspondence had already been published. And then you throw in things like his memoirs and all that, which are not as, you know, you can't go by them as much as you can the contemporary sources, but they are still, you know, important and so on. I use those as well. So tons and tons of his correspondence is available, and he absolutely corresponded with anybody you could think of. Everybody from President Lincoln to the powers that be in Washington, down to his corps commanders and at times division brigade commanders, to his family. He wrote Julia, his wife, very often. His father, others, and cousins, and you know, it's interesting reading through the grant papers. His you know, cousin would write and say, "Hey, my boy needs a job. Can you put him on your staff, or can you get him in a regiment that does, you know, so and so, and all that kind of stuff?" Departmental commanders under him, you name it, he corresponded with them. And in fact, he made the comment several times that he hates writing letters, and he doesn't answer. I think he tells his father one time that he doesn't answer like 1/20 of the letters that he gets, simply because he doesn't have time. And he adds in, maybe because I'm a little bit lazy too, and I hate to write letters, but he just doesn't have time to answer all this correspondence. But there is a wealth of correspondence that he does include, and it includes, you know, it runs the gamut, anybody you could think of.
Who did he, as far as the strategy, his military strategy, operations and tactics, were there any particular people he liked to bounce ideas off and maybe, you know, debate with through correspondence or even on the field?
Well, not necessarily through correspondence. He's not a big writer, like I said. He does have his corps commanders, of course, and his two kind of proteges are Sherman and McPherson. The thing about McPherson is he's so inexperienced that he's just kind of a yes man. He just kind of does whatever Grant tells him to, you know. In fact, our friend Ed Bars likes to say that if Grant turned a corner, McPherson would break his nose. So that's just kind of the McPherson relationship there. Sherman's a little bit different. Sherman does call him out when he thinks things, you know, he's not doing things like Sherman thinks he should. Sherman's a little bit of a mouth first kind of person anyway, you know, likes to talk and give his opinion and all of that. In fact, as I said, Sherman, you know, thinks Grant's doing wrong when he goes south of Vicksburg. He thinks he should go back to Memphis and start this campaign over and all of that. And Sherman tells him that, but Grant basically ignores him. And that's kind of the premise of the book. You know, the decision was always my own. Grant says that, you know, I've never really held a council of war. I've talked to officers. I've met with officers, got their input and all that. But, you know, I've basically made the decision on my own. In larger military history, it's kind of interesting, and maybe getting too deep here, I don't know. But,
no,
you know, you have the dual theorized manner of war, you know, the dual military thinkers. From the Napoleonic times, Clausewitz and Jomini, which Jomini is very much, let's take geographical points and let's keep a good firm line of supply and let's garrison these points once we take them before going, you know, after new points and all that. It's a very organized theoretical type of warfare. Clausewitz, on the other hand, is very much let's go after the enemy armies. You know, politics is very important. Politics is a suspension of war and all that kind of stuff. And forget the geographical points. Let's go after the enemy armies and let's go after the enemy and be proactive and all that kind of stuff. And most of the Civil War generation, of course, had read Jomini because it was translated prior to the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Clausewitz was not. So nobody really read Clausewitz. And as a result, most of the Civil War generation officers are Jomenian in theory. And, you know, they Halleck is a classic example. McClellan and all that, keep lines of supply and be careful and very, you know, organized way of war and so on. Not many were Clausewitzian, but Grant is one of those that was very much Clausewitzian, not Jomenian, which is interesting to think about because he had never read Clausewitz. And I kind of compare it a little bit with, you know, I grew up in the heyday of country music. Barbara Mandrell had that song, I Was Country When Country Wasn't Cool, you know. Yeah. And Grant, I kind of equate it with that. Grant was Clausewitzian when Clausewitzian wasn't cool. Nobody knew about Clausewitz, but Grant figured it out on his own, you know, without reading Clausewitz.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you mentioned that about Jomini, because, it, you know, if you think about were the Confederate generals also, I guess they would have taken that same approach.
Study under Jomini, you know, and at West Point, a lot of those went to West Point and had access to the translations and so on as well, yeah.
Would you say, and I guess this is maybe just getting into General Grant, or generally into how Grant thought, was he more of a maverick then among officers? Did he sort of break the mold, you know, break out of that?
I think definitely so. Yeah, he was very different than any of the others. And, you know, a classic case in point is, you look at the entire Civil War, and there were three big major captures of enemy armies that took place, and those were, of course, Fort Donelson, Vicksburg, mm-hmm. and Appomattox. And of course, who was the commander that captured all three of those?
Mm-hmm.
Grant. Nobody else seemed to be able to put it all together to get that done.
So I have a question about the one point about his decision to cut the railroad from the east to Vicksburg. Why was that a revolutionary thing to do?
Well, I don't know if it was necessarily revolutionary. It was more common sense than anything.
Mm-hmm.
If Vicksburg only has one supply line leading to it, other than the Mississippi River, which, of course, is capped to the north and the south by the Navy,
right?
Then, you know, it's pretty much common sense to go and cut the railroad, and then you've got it isolated, and you know, starve it out, basically. Outcamp them, as Grant says. The way he does it is a little bit revolutionary, and it's all involved with terrain and geography and so on. When Grant goes south of the river, he lands at a place called Bruinsburg, which is south of not only the major river that is shielding Vicksburg, which is the Big Black River, but it's also south of another major water course, which is called Bayou Pierre. And so Grant will have to get across both of those. And if the Confederates had been ready, they could have, you know, really defended the crossings of those rivers, because that makes it, you know, doubly difficult to get across those rivers and lay bridges and all that, just as, you know, Burnside and Fredericksburg, or, you know, World War II, the Rhine and Remagen, the importance of that bridge and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Confederates don't really do what they should in terms of sending those. But the key here is that Grant, when he crossed at Bruinsburg and took Grand Gulf, the best way to get to Vicksburg is go straight up the river, parallel with the river, northward to Vicksburg. But you would cross the Big Black River, which the Confederates may or may not have fought to defend. But what you're doing, you're putting yourself then in a very, very constricted, narrow triangle of land between the Mississippi River on your left, the Big Black River on your right, and the Confederates north of you. And you get bottled up in there, if something goes wrong, then you don't have any room to maneuver. You don't have any room to fix things or adapt or anything like that. So Grant chooses not to place himself in that restricted area. And as a result, he will march northeastward toward the railroad, to cut the railroad east of the Big Black River,
mm-hmm.
In order to to give himself more room to maneuver, and of course that's exactly what he does. He maneuvers, starting, you know, with those battles on the 12th at Raymond, which is a little bit of a surprise to him, and then takes Jackson, and then Champion Hill on the 16th, and then of course the fight for the Big Black River crossing itself on the 17th.
Mm-hmm.
So that, if there's a revolutionary part of it, it would be, that part, using geography to his advantage, so he won't be cooped up in a small area.
So how much time pressure did he have to achieve success, and how did he deal with that? And I'm thinking about also that it ended officially on July 4th, that campaign, which almost feels like someone wanted to make sure that's when it ended for, you know, PR.
There were a lot of Confederates that thought that, you know, Pemberton sold us out. He was a northern man from Pennsylvania anyway, and he sold us out on the best day that the Yankees could have come up with to capture Vicksburg, you know. But in truth, there's nothing to that. There was no planning for that. Pemberton, in fact, started negotiations on July the 3rd, and both Pemberton and Grant thought it would be wrapped up on the 3rd, but they carried over on into the morning of the 4th, and that's what happened. So there's nothing to these rumors that, you know, Pemberton sold Vicksburg, or they had a deal worked out, or anything like that. The time constraints really on Grant come in a couple of different ways. Number one, politically, Grant is under immense pressure. And bear in mind, this campaign is going on since October of 1862. And the Republicans are not doing well in those fall elections throughout November, and then you get into December, and you've got these defeats at Chickasaw Bio and Holly Springs, and then you've got the winter of all these attempts at Yazoo Pass, Steele's Bio, and the canal, and all that. You've got six failures over the course of some, you know, 6 or 7 months, and the politicians are, and particularly newspaper editors, they're stoking the fire. They're starting to really get on Grant. Even Lincoln is getting impatient. And so Grant is getting messages from Washington, particularly from Halleck, that's saying things like, you know, I don't really think I have to explain to you the impatience that's going on here in Washington, or I don't think I have to explain to you, the president's, you know, desire for you to wrap this Vicksburg thing up. You can read between the lines. And at one point he says, you know, I think you know this, but I'm going to tell you what the president is talking about. And there are a lot of, you know, folks calling for Grant's removal and all that. And there are rumors of drunkenness and so on like that. So Grant knows full well that his time is just about up. And as a result, he will, that's what almost leads him to launch this just suicidal attack, because he has no other option. And then he decides, well, we've got to do the non-theoretical thing, the non-textbook thing, and see if that works. And it's basically do or die, because politically we can't withdraw, we can't go back to Memphis, and that's the problem with Sherman's plan. Sherman wants to go back to Memphis and follow the secure rail lines and all that. But Grant knows full well that will be perceived as a defeat and a retreat by the army. And he politically probably will not survive this. And, certainly in terms of morale and northern morale and all that, it just would not look good at all. So he is under immense pressure in terms of politics and his own position. And so he's also under pressure, and this is one of the interesting things I found, he wants to get this done as early as he can in the spring, and even May, you know. That's why, one of the reasons he assaults on the 19th and the 22nd, so that he can go ahead and get this done, so he'll leave time later in the summer to do other things, you know, go against Mobile or campaigns in the Mississippi or whatever. Mm-hmm. In fact, he writes, I believe, his father, and says, you know, I expected a whole bunch more out of this. Yes, we're going to get Vicksburg. It's, I think it's right about when they were about to capture Vicksburg, whatever. Yeah, it's going to be a great victory, but he says, I really wanted so much more of it. But now, you know, July of 1863, it's the season, the campaigning season, he says, is almost don't, and there's really not much else we can do because it's just getting so blasted hot here in August and deep in Mississippi, you know. So there is also the geographical time factor, the environmental time factor, if you will, that's also pressing him, and he doesn't survive that quite as well, although it is a major victory, obviously. Grant wanted it to go a little quicker and wanted a little more out of it.
So it seems like the pressure, rather than making him panic, though it sounds like it came close at times, made him hunker down and really think about how to accomplish what he needed to.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, people talk, I think, was it Ken Burns or somebody talking about this 3 o'clock in the morning courage that somebody wakes you up and says, they've turned your left flank, what do you do? And just very calmly you can say, okay, here's what we're going to do, don't panic. And you know, that's the hallmark of Grant. You see it one time and you think, okay, and see it twice and, okay, that's pretty good. But you see a pattern over and over and over in Grant that at Belmont, you know, when the Confederates send reinforcements over, which they weren't supposed to, they're not playing right, you know, and we get pushed back, Grant doesn't panic. He doesn't give up. And, he just fights his way back at Fort Donelson. When the Confederates counterattack, which nobody thought they would do that, Grant doesn't panic. He just starts sending more forces in, ammunition to the front, starts a counterattack at Shiloh after, you know, the massive bloodbath that was the first day. Grant doesn't panic. Sherman comes to him and basically says, you know, let's get out of here. Let's get across the river. Let's retreat. Says, you bet the devil's own day. Grant says, yeah, we'll come tomorrow, though. And you know, he's going into the overland campaign in Virginia over and over and over. He doesn't panic. He doesn't give in. He doesn't give up. And I think that just tenacity, bulldog tenacity, not to give up, is one of the major hallmarks of Grant.
So considering he didn't like to write a lot, during the Vicksburg campaign, how good was he at organizing everything with his army as far as making sure logistics were moving correctly, that people were doing what they were supposed to, you know, where they were supposed to? Was he good at that, and how did he accomplish it?
He was. Everybody touts Grant's very succinct and clear orders. I beg to differ on that maybe just a little bit. Grant was not, you know, end all be all. He made mistakes as well, and there are examples during the Vicksburg campaign when he sends orders, particularly to McClernand, who they didn't get along with each other, obviously, but McClernand just doesn't understand and has to send back for clarification. Well, do you really mean this, or do you mean that? You know, explain exactly what you mean. In another occasion, Grant went out of the chain of command and ordered an entire division to go a certain place after he had ordered McClernand to leave a brigade at a certain place. And the division commander, finally, you know, the division marches off with the corps commander, McClernand, wondering, what are you doing? You know, I haven't given you orders to do that. Well, they came from Grant. Finally, the division commander has to send word to McClernand and Grant, okay, I'm getting conflicting orders here. Which should I obey? You know, so there are examples of chaos, and I mean, you can't run a system like this without some chaos, you know, on the fly and adapting continuously and all of that. One of the problems that Grant has is that he has a lot of trouble with staff work. His staff, particularly early in the war, and there's a good book on this, I can't remember exactly what book it was, maybe The Right Hand of Command or something like that. It talks about staffs and staff work and all that, and it makes the point that Grant's staff early in the war was really not that professional and really doesn't serve him very well because it's kind of cronyism. Grant picks a lot of his friends and people he knew from before and his former regiment and all that kind of stuff that really don't have any business being on a Army commander staff, but they're his buddies and so on. And, you know, that's another kind of, you see patterns in Grant's life. That's another pattern. Grant kind of, he's a very confident, knows what he's doing, handles things good, all of that kind of stuff, but he's a poor judge of character sometimes. Mm-hmm. And he, even in his presidential administrations, you know, he picks a lot of his cronies, cronyism and so on, for cabinet officials, and they start getting him into a whole lot of trouble, even though he was not particularly involved in any of these scandals. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a bunch of losers in his cabinet that he had picked that, that got him into scandals and so on. So, he has trouble with that, and he's not served terribly well by his staff at Vicksburg. In fact, he's missing several key members of his staff. They've either gone home or gone to visit home or furlough or something, and or resigned and haven't replaced them and all of that. So it winds up that Grant has to do a lot of the work, and he may be one of the classic, you know, micromanagers that he just can't help but get involved in the little stuff that really the Army commander has no business whatsoever being involved in. Mm-hmm. And that'll catch up to him at times, because as much correspondence as he's doing, you just can't do it all, you know. And there's that, you know, other 19th, 20th of the correspondence that he just cannot get to, and something's gonna fall between the cracks when you try to do it like that.
So I have a question about how he dealt with the local populace, and I ask because I guess at the end of the campaign he paroled the Southern garrison rather than sent him to prison. So I'm curious about his attitude towards the locals that they encountered while campaigning.
Well, Grant is very, what's the word I'm looking for? He's very nice to the locals. He doesn't want to trouble them any more than possible, but he does hold a firm line with them that, you know, we're not going to go out of our way or risk anything militarily just to be nice to the local civilians and the population and so on. And so if he runs across civilians that are in need, even if they're Southerners, you know, that are not sympathetic to the Union or anything, you know, he won't necessarily order their houses burned or anything. If he runs across Unionists, people who are loyal to the Union, he will certainly aid them and provide, you know, guards for their farmhouses and so on like that. So he's a very tender-hearted man. He's a very, you know, you may have you know people like this just personally even today that, you know, I know people that are just almost downright rotten, just enjoy being mean just to be mean. And then I know people that are just absolutely genuine, good-hearted, wouldn't hurt anybody, would do anything for anybody and so on like that. And Grant seemed to be that kind of person. He seemed to be a genuinely nice person that cared for people, even the enemy. Didn't want to do them anything, you know, that would necessarily hurt them. Now, you mentioned the parole thing. Mm-hmm. That was not necessarily anything to do with the whole, you know, let's treat them and be nice and all that kind of stuff. That was basically a military decision. Mm-hmm. And it was one really Grant, and this is kind of the anomaly, and, you know, the decision was always my own. This was one that really he made, but he was not really in favor of. He does talk to some of his officers and says, what do you think about the parole? What do we do? You know, Grant wanted to send them all north on boats, like he had done at Fort Donelson, put them all in prison camp. And most of his officers, all of them, I believe, except Frederick Steele, division commander in Sherman's corps, which when Sherman leaves to go to the rear, he commands Sherman's corps around the siege line there. But he and Frederick Steele wanted to basically pack them all up, send them north like they'd done after Fort Donelson. Most everybody else said, no, this is ludicrous. It would just be too much. It'll overcrowd the penal system in the north. It'll overtax, you know, the shipping and the Navy and all that. Admiral Porter himself says, you know, this would not be really a good idea. So when Grant really gets the majority of his people saying, you know, you got to rethink this. This is really probably not a good idea. He does acquiesce and decides just to parole the Confederates right there.
So, considering that you said Grant was tender-hearted, how did he maintain discipline among his officers and men, especially, let's say, some of them decided to treat locals badly or just cause problems? How did he discipline them, and did he do anything special in the Vicksburg campaign as far as discipline?
Well, there will be examples of him disciplining and threatening to discipline. A lot of times he will leave that. Those are, even though he does get involved in some minutiae and so on, those are kind of lower-level command. You leave that to corps commanders and division, even brigade commanders, to kind of maintain the discipline. You lay down in there numerous orders about, you know, don't loot, don't pillage, and all that kind of stuff coming down from the top. But mostly it's hard for Grant to enforce that, you know. Most of that is done at the lower-level officers. But there are examples when Grant gets involved. For instance, if cavalry regiments get a little too big for their britches and, you know, start messing with the Confederates a little too much and so on. I have one regiment, I think it's the 7th Kansas, the Jayhawkers in particular. He threatens to lock their colonel up and take away their horses. It might have been that regiment. He threatens to dismount the regiment and take away their guns and all of that, and he threatens at times to hold back their pay, you know, if they don't do so-and-so. One instance in the early campaign, Mississippi Central campaign there in November and December of 1862, there was, I'm trying to remember the story now, a unionist came in to his headquarters and said, you know, they robbed me and my family, took away the jewelry and all that. They were Mississippians, but they were loyal to the Union, you know. And so Grant sent this letter to the commander that said, a couple of men from your unit apparently went into this farmhouse, and one of them was called Bill and one of them Andrew or something like that in the conversation that, you know, stole the jewelry and all that. If you can figure out who these are, you know, punish them at the lowest level you can get down to. If you find out who they were, punish them. If you find out, you know, not exactly who it was, but what company they were in that did this, punish the whole company. Or if you can only get down to the regiment, punish the whole regiment, you know. So he did get involved in fairly local things like that at times.
Okay. Well, let me turn towards the resources you used. You said you used 32 volumes of correspondence, and you said a lot of materials that have been published. Did you find any other, you know, dusty old tomes that people haven't opened in a while, or, you know, what did you find anything special that you added to this study?
Well, not really. Most, as I said, there's, you know, a biography a week coming out on Grant now, it seems. And tons of biographies through the years. And so there's not any really old biographies or anything that haven't been treated per se. And especially with the advent of the internet, you know, you today, when I first started writing books 20 years ago, you had to, you know, go to archives and find these old books and all that kind of stuff, you know. Today you can just get on Google Books or HathiTrust or Archive, whatever it is, org or whatever, and all these books are digitized, you know. So these books like Richardson's biography of Grant, Badeau's two-volume biography of Grant, that comes out in like the 1860s, are right there at your fingertips, you know. You can utilize those. So those are, there's not a lot that is really groundbreaking in terms of Grant studies. There's one source, though, that hasn't been used probably like it should, although it is not a contemporary source. It's a post-war source, kind of a memoir type thing. But when Grant went on this world tour in the late 1870s, a New York newspaper correspondent went with him. It was James Russell Young, I believe is his name. And he wrote, a two-volume history of Grant's world tour. And what they would do is, a lot of this was done on steamship, of course. You didn't fly to Europe and then take a tour of Europe. You took it on steamship. And then they went all around, you know, the Indian Ocean and Mediterranean and the Pacific and all that. So they had a lot of time sitting on the deck of these steamboats. And so he would just query Grant, you know, they were big buddies and so on. And he would just, you know, tell me about the Vicksburg campaign. So and so, tell me going. And Grant would just sit there and just blabber about everything, and Young was taking all this down, and he published it. So there's a lot of good source material that, you know, again, it's post-war memoir-type stuff, but it does give you an idea of Grant's mindset, particularly of what he thought of what he had done, you know, and some anecdotal material and so on. But a lot of that Young stuff hasn't been used too much, but it's pretty interesting.
So there were no situations where you saw something that had been published and you thought, you know what, I'm not sure I this might be right, and you ever go back to a primary source and look it up just to make sure?
Oh yeah, that happens all the time. And in fact, I don't mind. There's a big debate going on now about Grant's memoirs and how reliable they are. And again, they were written 20 years after the war. And Grant, again, was not perfect. He was not above trying to make himself look better when he's writing his memoirs. I mean, that's what presidents do today when George Bush or Bill Clinton or whoever writes their memoir, they're going to make themselves look as good as they can. And that's what Grant's doing. And there are times, however, when what Grant says happened, or what he thought happened, or what he was thinking at any given time, as described in his memoirs, just does not jive with what he's writing in his personal letters back to Julia or his father or whoever that are found in the 32 volumes of the Grant papers. You know, so you have to be careful. And as a result, whenever there's a discrepancy or you know, you don't have to even just go looking for discrepancies. You certainly don't want to just use Grant's memoirs as your major source and not even go through the Grant correspondence. In my view, you use the Grant correspondence as your major source, and that's kind of the standard, because that tells you what he is thinking at the time, and then the Grant memoirs would be the kind of anecdotal verifying source, if you will, or whatever. And if the two don't match up, I always go with the contemporary source at the time.
Did you, for this book, did you go back to the Vicksburg area or the Campaign area at all?
Well, I grew up down there, so I'm extremely familiar with it. I've written books on portions of the Vicksburg Campaign and so on. So really didn't have to do a whole lot of ground truthing or really digging down there. And like I said, I didn't really have to go into a whole lot of archives and so on. But, you know, in a book like this, we kept these books, when I say we, the series editors and the publisher, we kept these at about 80,000-90,000 words, which is only about a, 250 or so page book, which to some people and, you know, college students that care nothing about it reading, it's going to say, why am I going to read such a big book? You know, but in the scheme of things, it's not that big a book. I've written battle books, you know, the Shiloh book is 600 pages total, with index and all that, you know. So these aren't terribly big books. And as a result, you can't go into just minute detail on much of anything. It's more of a monograph overview of a certain aspect of Grant's life. And so as a result, didn't just go into huge depth on pretty much anything. It's more of a larger overview.
Okay. What part of the research for this book did you find most enjoyable?
I think probably reading through Grant's papers, which that, you know, is if you're, and what I kind of equate it to now is nosy people who sign up with people on Facebook to see what they had for lunch or whatever. You know, there's some people that just thrive on that nosiness and just want to know everything about everybody. And, you know, that's kind of, historians are nosy. And when we go read people's personal correspondence, that they never, you know, some soldier in the trenches of Vicksburg in the siege writing home to mama, he never has the faintest inkling that people 160 years later, are going to be reading his letter and, you know, talking about him in a book or something. So I think that aspect is something that we can understand with this whole Facebook thing. I don't do Facebook, but you know, it's kind of something similar. So in that sense, I think what I enjoyed more than anything was just sitting down and reading through. And the Vicksburg campaign covers about 3 volumes in Grant's papers. You know, I think it's like volume 6, 7, and 8 or something like that. And these are like 600 page books, you know. Unfortunately, the print's fairly large, but, that's not something, you know, it's not really a page turner. You don't just sit down and say, okay, I'm going to read all of Grant's letters, you know, today. So it's not something you normally just sit down and read for enjoyment, but, obviously I had to for this book, and reading his letters to his wife and his letters to his family and his letters to this, that, and the other, and all that was just kind of interesting. It was interesting getting a view of Grant. You get a real personal view of the man, you know.
What did you find in there that was most surprising to you?
Probably, maybe the just the vast amount of correspondence that he was involved in. I mean, every day would be, and again, we could equate it to something like, you know, Facebook posts or blog posts or something like that. Most people don't blog 4 or 5 things a day or post, well, I guess some post that many on Facebook. I don't know. I don't write 4 or 5 or 10 different letters a day to people. Now, I probably do send that many or more emails. So the best thing we could probably do is, you know, how many emails do you get and send per day. But just the, you know, it's easy now to just tap out an email and fire it off, you know, but it was a whole lot more to it to write a letter in those days, you know, and send it. So, if we did quantify it, you know, we could say, you know, if one letter in those days equaled 10 emails a day, and he wrote 10 letters a day, you know, would equate to 100 emails, you know, today or something like that. You know, all that's hypothetical. But just the sheer amount of correspondence, I think, is staggering. And how he was juggling, I guess, so many different things. I mean, yes, he was an Army commander waging probably what would become the most important and largest and most complex military campaign of the Civil War, but at the same time he's administering his department and taking care of politics and trade and all that kind of stuff back home. And then he's got a lot of his family stuff with cousins wanting jobs and his father trying to get in on the trade and get rich and all that kind of stuff, you know. And we know about the headaches with him, you know, kicking out the Jews and all that kind of stuff. He stumbles at times. But then you have the innermost correspondence, you know, with his wife and children, and he's very concerned about his kids' education, you know, let's get them in school and where they are and what they're doing and sending presents home to them and all that. So just juggling all of that at one time is, you know, and again, I think about us today, and it's maybe not that far apart from us, you know, juggling a 40-hour week job, and then you come home and you have your ball team that you know, coach, and you have to do that, and then you have your church, and you're involved in your church work, and then you have your family that, you know, you're dealing with, and then you have, you know, maybe something else that out there that you're involved in. You have to kind of juggle all that, but yeah. You know, commanding armies and lives in your hands and politics and dealing with the president and all that, I think, is a little larger than what most of us deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So was there a question you came across while researching this book that you just had a difficult time getting an answer to? Maybe you still haven't answered it or just took a while for you to nail down?
Not really on this book. Again, probably because it's such a and I hate to sell myself short. It, you know, it took a lot of research and a lot of time writing it and all that kind of stuff, but it is, by definition, kind of an overview and a larger overview, so you don't get down into kind of the minutiae stuff. I do have things like that in a lot of the books that I deal with, particularly the battle books. You know, I've done large battle books on Shiloh and Fort Donelson and Corinth and working on several now, Vicksburg and all that. And there always seems to be one brigade or something like that that you're still just kind of fuzzy on, that the reports just don't make any sense and you just can't find any letters or diaries or anything that sheds much light on it. And there'll always be things like that. And, you know, the temptation is just to hold off and wait until we know everything about everything. But if that was the case, no book would ever get published. You'd still, you know, be working on your first book kind of thing. And so you just have to pull the trigger and publish it at some point. And there's nothing wrong with a historian saying, you know, I really don't know this. I you know, the evidence is just not there. It's just not clear exactly how this brigade went into action or did that. And again, a lot of that is the military stuff, tactics and movements and so on like that, you know. But didn't really run into anything like that necessarily on this book.
So did you have any challenges getting this book done? I assume that getting it published, you know, it's part of the series, so that wasn't a problem. But as far as actually completing it, do you have any issues or?
No, I didn't. In fact, I completed it pretty quickly. It helped that I didn't have to go to, you know, tons and tons of archives and repositories all over the nation. You pretty much have the sources all right there in the office. You know, I don't own a personal copy of all 32 volumes of the grant papers. I do own the 100 and whatever it is, 28 volumes of the official records. But the grant papers, I did have to buy, you know, like volume, well, I already had like 5 and 6 dealing with Fort Donelson and Shiloh and all that. But I bought 7, 8, 9, and 10 or whatever, you know, to have them right there and mark them up and all that kind of stuff. So it helps a lot when you've got the sources right at your fingertips, you know. And so, no, I didn't. This was a pretty smooth book and didn't really run into much of anything of that sort. Of course, when you get to 19 or 20 books, you kind of know what you're doing by that point and kind of know the pitfalls and all that and what to watch out for. So no real major troubles on this one.
Okay, good. And I see, as I noted before we started recording, you have a book on Benjamin Grierson coming out soon. Do you have anything? What's your next project after that one?
Well, I'm working on now, continuing with Vicksburg. I've kind of exhausted my, worn out my welcome, if you will, on the Tennessee River campaign, because I wrote a book on Fort Donelson, and then Shiloh, and then Corinth. And so I've done big, you know, 500-600 page books on those. So now I'm moving on down the Mississippi Valley and dealing more with Vicksburg, which, you know, this book kind of obviously is involved in that. Grierson's raid is as well. Mm-hmm. But the next major book is going to be a look at Grant's assaults on May the 19th and May the 22nd, which gets a chapter in this book. But this is going to be, you know, one of those 500-600 page books that that'll be quite substantial doorstop kind of thing. And then, of course, I'm going to move on and do, right after that, the siege. It's not really a good, comprehensive academic treatment of the siege itself. So I'll do that. And then, if I feel like it, I may go back and do it out of order, but I thought about I could do a volume on the Mississippi Central campaign in Chickasaw Bayou in November and December, and then do a volume on the winter roundabout, you know, stuff, the Yazoo Pass and Steele's Bayou and all that, the canal and the attempts to get to Vicksburg, and then maybe one on the overland campaign when Grant crosses the river, or Port Hudson, or Port Gibson and Raymond Jackson, Champion Hill, and all that kind of stuff, which put all those together would make a nice little 5-volume history of the Vicksburg campaign. So, but all that's way in the future. So I'm just continually thinking about what I do next. It's strictly a hobby. You know, I don't shoot pool or play golf or chase women or anything like that. I stay at home and basically write and research. So really enjoy doing that, and I'm continually thinking, you know, several books down the line and so on.
So do you find that interest in the U.S. Civil War is continuing at a steady pace, or is it increasing, decreasing? You know, is,
well, I think it's definitely decreasing. You know, used to when I was, you know, just getting into this and so on, and really buying up books and going whole hog into it and so on. You go to a Barnes & Noble or a Books A Million or something like that, and there used to be huge sections, just shelf after shelf after shelf, labeled Civil War, you know, huge sections of Civil War. And you go into one of those now, and there are no sections, Civil War sections. The Civil War books are encompassed within maybe the military history section or maybe just the U.S. history section, and there's a very small contingent of Civil War books. The big thing now, of course, is World War II and Vietnam.
Yeah,
which are really, really blossoming these days. And I go around, you know, speak all over the country and speak to round tables and all that. And I mean, you do notice that the population at those things that people are interested in are probably 60 and above, you know. Mm-hmm. And you think, you know, in 20 years or so, this is going to die out. Although, you know, I am convinced that young people in their 20s and 30s and all that probably have very little time right now in their stage of life to be too involved in this and go to yet another meeting, you know, on a Tuesday night or whatever, mm-hmm. much less the funds to put into this, to join a club. And, you know, some of these ritzy ones in New York City or Chicago or something like that, it costs $50-$60 to go to a meeting and you do dinner and all that, you know. So they probably don't have the time or the funds to get involved, and you only do that once you get older and, you know, more stable in life and so on. And I've often wondered, these 60, 70-year-old folks at these round tables now, were they involved in a round table in historic organizations and so on when they were in their 20s and 30s? They probably weren't. They probably came to it late in life. So I'm hoping, you know, that the young folks, 20s and 30s and so on today, will gain an appreciation and will keep the fires going, you know, in the future, which is probably what has happened to this generation. You know, the centennial generation back in the 1960s probably said the same thing. You know, it's all a bunch of retired folks that are interested, and right. We're not going to have any Civil War history in the 1980s or 1990s, but it does seem to continually perpetuate. But, you know, I have seen enough to know that interest in the Civil War is somewhat declining, even with that said.
Yeah, I think they need a good video game. It's set in, you know, with a Civil War setting for kids to.
And
certainly Westerns are still, you know, still maintain popularity, and all those characters are all like, you know, former Union or Confederate soldiers who went West, you know, that sort of thing. So
So
apart from Amazon, is there anywhere else online people can find your works or stuff you're writing?
Well, probably Amazon would be the best place. You can get them in, you know, Battlefield bookstores and so on. If you go to Barnes & Nobles, you know, every once in a while somebody will tell me, I had some friends in New York City, went to New York City earlier in the summer, and they texted me a picture of a kid holding up the book, you know, one of my books, and said, "We found you in New York City." So you do see them, you know, in actual bookstores around the nation, but most of the bookstores, the big ones, you know, Barnes and Nobles and Books A Million and all that kind of stuff, don't carry University Press books and so on. Just, you know, they can't carry that many and so on. So probably Amazon would be the best place, or a Battlefield bookstore or something like that.
All right. That's all my questions. Do you have any final thoughts?
No. It's just that Grant's an interesting character. You know, I'm somewhat of a Grant fan, I'll admit, but I'm not afraid to call Grant out when I, you know, see problems with him. All of us are human, you know, there's only one perfect person that's ever lived, and he died for us, but Grant's not perfect, I'm not perfect, and so to write 150 years later that, you know, he should have done this and he was wrong on this and all that, I'm not sure I have the right to be doing that, so I just kind of call it like I see it and let the readers decide. But he's a very interesting person, and the Vicksburg campaign is the key campaign of the war that he's involved in, certainly, but probably the key campaign of the war in general, certainly the most complex, and probably the one that gives the most benefit to the Union.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting to study.
All right. Well, thank you for speaking with me.
Well, thank you for having me. I very much appreciate it and enjoy it.
Thank you for listening. One of the best ways to provide feedback on this podcast is to rate it on iTunes. Please let me know if you liked it, or give me a poor rating if you didn't like this podcast, and I can use that feedback to hopefully get better. Otherwise, please follow me on Instagram at Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, on Twitter at War Scholar, on Facebook under War Scholar, and you can find more information on my website, warscholar.org. Please remember, my name, Chris, does not have an H, so it's CRISALVAREZ. Thank you, and I hope you continue to enjoy this podcast.